interesting here is that when you put the dipole horizontally and then you change that horizontal tubing to the vertical by cranking it, after that you still have a few elements that you can telescopically raise up and put the bolt inside and make it as conveniently high as it's possible. Enter XGN. Okay. So, and then he says about the tools that she was using, the Dremel tool, the end of the story is that I was interested not really with the antenna in all of the three videos. I was interested with the technicality of it. How much time the ham radio operator can spend of his own to prepare and make something, and that's what is the most amazing. Dr. Rory, back to you.
Well, yeah, I mean that there are many amateurs still who have little setups in their garages or their basements. It's rather fascinating. They can bend metal. They can do all kinds of useful things. I remember sometimes it's a matter of knowing people. I've been looking at a certain design for an antenna where other people are adding loading coils to get its resonance to 80 and 160. And there's one gentleman, I think he calls him his little thing a Jolie, a coil, because his name is Jolie or something close to that. And he took PVC and he took it over to a machinist who engraved a spiral a valley into the PVC to make it easier for him to run some enameled copper wire as the inductor and such. So sometimes people, you know, Eric, may rest in peace, had a lot of fabrication equipment, so some hams are able to do it all themselves, and others just have useful friends.
Yes, sir. If you were to buy the ready-to-use the antenna, I would pay a lot of money for it. But sometimes ham radio operators can go around them and make their own antenna that is like the manufactured by for sale, and it looks amazing. Anyhow, that's all for now, and back to you, and to XGN.
Okay, thank you very much, Wesley. Next on my list for tonight is Ken, WB2KWC. What's your question or comments or topic for tonight, Ken?
Okay, good evening, Roy. Just a comment. Somebody had mentioned that the CW end of the 10-meter band was rather active. This weekend, it sweepstakes. It's the CW weekend of sweepstakes. So if you look at the bottom of almost any band, it's quite crowded. Has nothing to do with the conditions of your antenna. It's just that everybody is on. AC2GS, WB2KW3.
Okay, very good, Ken. Yeah, I suspected that it was probably a CW contest, because that brings the most people out, but you still need that combination of propagation and the contest, your supply and demand, if you will. So, you know, last year or the year before or the year before that, I don't think the CW end of 10 meters was quite as active as it was this morning. So, thanks for adding to that, Ken.
Ken, what contest is this?
This is the ARRL sweepstakes. It ends 10 o'clock this evening, Eastern Time.
You look at 40, it's wall-to-wall CW. Wall-to-wall, it's amazing.
Yep. listen for my call, you'll hear it.
Okay, very good, Ken. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Weimar Technical Mess. If you have any questions or comments or topics for discussion tonight, feel free, hit that push to talk button, give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, I'll bring out some semi-puzzlers. Before I do, though, I want to remind people there's a lunar eclipse coming. We'll be here November 8th in the middle of the night. So for you insomniacs, this is a perfect opportunity. You know, go out in your pajamas at around 3 o'clock in the morning and watch the last significant lunar eclipse, apparently, until 2025. So keep that in mind. But circle it on your calendar. Okay, on to a little micro-puzzle. I saw, and I put it on my link page, which is roy.ac2gs.com, the dumbest puzzle I've ever seen on YouTube. Basically, the title of the puzzle of this particular YouTube is What Happens When You Plug a Suicide Cord in a Live Outlet? Do Not Try This Ever, is the name of this insipid YouTube. Now, for people who weren't listening a few weeks ago, suicide cord is a euphemism for a electrical outlet cord with plugs on both sides. And it's, I guess, designed for raving lunatics to plug in their generator to their house outlet and risk the lives of linemen and all kinds of people to electrocution. So it's basically an extension cord with a plug on both ends. So this guy's question, and my question, and I hope all of you get it right, is what the heck happens if you go to one of those outlets that have two, you can plug two things in, top to the bottom, and you plug this suicide cord in the top end, and then you take the other end and you plug the other end of the suicide cord into the lower end. And he says, do not try this ever. Would anyone like to volunteer what might happen?
82, am I?
Yes. Yes, I think it's 82, MIY.
Kilo Delta 2, Mike India. My name is John. And the outlet is wired correctly, nothing will happen.
Right you are. I mean, usually, as far as I'm aware, most outlets are just kind of ganged in line. So it would have to be the outlet from hell to kind of, they would have to have lit the connector on both sides and crosswire them. Anyway, so very, very silly YouTube. Obviously, all things being equal, nothing happens because you're plugging in two cords to the same polarity. You're not cross-polarity connecting them. You're not shorting anything out. You're just wasting your time. But that made it to a YouTube, and I wonder how many bucks that guy got from ad revenue. Let me drop for a second, and I'll find you some other little puzzling. Okay, here's another one. It's at the very edges of technology, but it still counts, in my opinion. There is a company out there, a multi-billion dollar company, that manufactures billions of dollars of products that is listed as a non-profit organization. Gold star for anyone who could guess what company is a non-profit organization that's worth over $8 billion.
I'm thinking the NFL, but I think they went profit in WB2BO.
Okay, that's a good guess. They don't really sell anything, except, I guess, their sports. But this is a manufacturer of very expensive stuff that most of us could not afford. No one out there wants to hazard a guess. Points will not be taken away.
Could it possibly be a utility company?
Well, that's an interesting thing, but no, it's not a utility company.
Could you repeat the question?
Certainly. There is a company out there that's valued at approximately $8 billion that sells billions and billions of dollars of manufactured items, yet is listed somehow as a non-profit organization.
KD2WOT.
Yes, Chris.
I believe that's the National Rifle Association.
Well, thankfully, they're not worth $8 billion. At this point, they're close, I think, to bankruptcy, and they don't manufacture much except for T-shirts and mugs and such. So, no, it's not, but it's a good guess.
It is a non-profit organization.
Yes, there are many non-profit organizations. As a matter of fact, if you do just a look-up of, say, the top 100 non-profit organizations, this particular company doesn't show up for whatever reason, but it is a non-profit organization. And as I mentioned, there are many out there, but this is the flim-flammiest.
Is it some form of religious organization?
No. I'll give you a hint. It's a manufacturer, so they do have products. We've all heard of their products. Some of us have lusted after their products, and others don't give a darn. But it's a manufacturer. Any other guesses out there? I'm sure there's someone sitting back who has a good idea what this might be. And, you know, what the hell? I'll even let you Google it. So, see what you come up with. Well, I'm sorry to feel you're not in the mood for puzzles tonight. I'll give you one more chance to kind of come up with some guess, and then I guess I'll have to kind of ruin the whole thing by just telling you. But one more time, if anyone's out there and would like to hazard a guess of a non-profit, multi-billion-dollar corporation that manufactures toys for wealthy people, give it a try.
Is it an aircraft manufacturer? But could you give us a hint, Roy?
How many employees, Roy?
I don't know exactly. Well, it's not a airplane manufacturer. I don't know how many employees they have. They make a million units per year of this expensive product that I think starts maybe at $5,000 or $10,000 a clip. So hopefully that's a good hit.
Yeah, one question: is the nonprofit status intentional?
Oh, I think it's incredibly intentional.
Should ask what rich people do, play golf, so then this area, and take you.
Golf? I don't think they have any particular tie-in with golf.
How long have they been around? Decades?
Yes, many decades.
How
about the Hudson Bay Company?
It's not them. As another hint, they became a non-profit organization, I believe, in the 1960s.
Okay, so it's not golf, yacht, airplane, but we excluded already airplane. It's expensive cars, but I don't know about any non-profit cars. What else?
Well, some people wear this product. Pretty much everyone wears this product. So it's something that's wearable.
Betty Felice.
Well, but they're not a non-profit organization. But you're hot. You're not there yet.
They're a watch manufacturer?
Yep.
Horace.
No, it's not Patek Philippe.
Rolex.
You are right. It is Rolex. Rolex is an $8 billion company. It manufactures, yes, N2YTK in the chat room, and John, KD2BD, gets it. They are roughly estimated to be worth $8 billion. They supposedly manufacture a million of those expensive watches that so many people want so badly. I don't think they're that terribly attractive personally, and I don't think they're worth the kind of money that they go for, but in 1960, the owner of Rolex passed the ownership on to a non-profit organization in Switzerland. Where the money goes from there is no one has a clue. So my tendency is to believe that it's just tax fraud in action, that the Swiss don't mind. But I found it fascinating that a company like Rolex is considered a non-profit organization of all things.
Wait, I got it. I got it first. I said, watch manufacturer, credit where credit is due, please.
Well, a guy before you mentioned the Patek, and I said that it wasn't that, but it was wearable, so, you know, it's kind of, it kind of guided everything, I think, to watches. It's just, you know, Rolex is, to me, probably, if you ask me of an expensive brand, I probably would say Rolex first, because it seems to be in my face all over the place. You know, everyone is flashing a Rolex on YouTube and such. Still, fascinating detail. You know, like I said, it's been going on since 1960. The Swiss are a wee bit confused about the whole thing, but apparently they're letting it go on like this. So it's basically just a glorified tax fraud.
And the question is, should we consider the same rules for non-profit in the United States and Europe? In the United States, non-profit is good business. You don't pay taxes, and you pay only from that what you pay to your, everything is free of tax. Should we consider the same rules for, I don't know, I have a problem with assigning it to fraud entrepreneurship.
Well, it's not like Rolex is going to sue me for slander or libel. The Swiss non-for-profit organizations apparently do not require documenting a great deal, which is why the Swiss government has no idea of where the money's coming and going to. And it is certainly of a tax benefit. Every article that I've read about, for the most part, it's very obscure. They're certainly not transparent. So there is a tax benefit in being registered as nonprofit, and apparently in Switzerland, there's not a significant amount of proof required. So. They might be spending the money and giving $5 to the Red Cross, and to them that's a nonprofit organization. So again, I don't think as popular as the Limark Technical Net is, I don't think the guys over in Switzerland they're going to sue me for anything I say.
I have a right in the United States to enter here.
Okay, I just thought it was an interesting little fact, and we had actually discussed expensive watches a month or two ago, so I figured, what the hell, we'll give it a try. Anyone else want to make any comments about this? I have one more puzzler in my back pocket.
Surprise, Tesla and Twitter are based in Switzerland.
Well, that they might do that. Probably they would be better off even with some kind of small island, place. Or, you know, move it to Ireland that doesn't pay taxes. So there's lots of interesting, useful locations they might want. And, you know, with all the firings that Elon has done, it's not going to be that difficult to move all the employees.
And you're trying to ignite a situation.
That's
about this law. Now, this law is not new. For anybody who has his own money, he got questioned by IRS. But this money came from based on that day in 1999. That actually is a very smart move because the Russian bandits, I'm not saying the whole Russian are bandits, but there are some Russians, they are bandits, who are actually overwhelming there, are trying to move money back.
W2BZ?
Yes, Rich? Yes, Rich?
I have a question for you, Roy. I forgot about it. I thought about it during the week. I wanted to ask you if you feel that COVID is going out like a lamb, but going out nonetheless.
Well, at this point, by the way, AP2GS, at this point it's more crystal ball gazing than it is real science. Generally speaking, infectious processes usually mutate towards heightened infectability and decreased morbidity. The idea is you have a lot of sufferers spreading it farther and wider. So the same thing was demonstrated in the influenza epidemic of 1918. We still have the descendants of that epidemic, H1N1. Strain of influenza type A. If you got your vaccine this year, which you should, it's usually a trivalent. One of them is for influenza A. Again, that's a descendant of the terrible influenza pandemic virus. So that's often what happens to viruses. That's my hope and guess of what's going to happen to COVID. It's going to kind of descend into the point where it's just going to be part of a winter cold spectrum. They might offer a booster separately, or they might combine it with the influenza, but hopefully that's what it will be. So I don't see it disappearing. I see it fading in influence gradually to the point that it becomes hopefully little more than it is.
Is there any chance at all that it could come back, can come roaring back?
Well, unfortunately, yes. Although the tendency and the trend is, as I mentioned before, increased infectability but decreased morbidity, it is within the realm of possibilities that something goes left instead of right and mutates, and there's a new novel sub-strain that could kill people. It's a toss of the dice, unfortunately. It's somewhat unlikely, but not impossible.
The question is, what beat it down? The answer can't be masks or number of people vaccinated, can it? I mean, or did it just run its course?
Well, it's a combination of things. We lessen the impact with vaccination and social distancing. If you go back again to the 1918 pandemic, which is probably the pandemic we have the best numbers for, the ones that happened earlier, which is almost anyone's guess, there were about 50 million people who died in the world due to the influenza pandemic, as opposed to 5 or 6 billion people who died from this virus. So we moderated the infectious rate and the terminal aspect of the original set of viruses, but there were more than enough infectable people to spread and allow multiple mutations to end up deriving the most infectious variety. A viral particle that mutated to be 10 or 20 or 30 times more infectious than the first version is going to spread a lot farther than the original one, which is what happened. So we spared probably about, 50 million people dying and having long COVID and such, and natural genetics mutated the strain to a less virulent type. How much of it is the virulence inherent in the new version, and how much of it is due to the fact that a large percentage of the population have either been vaccinated or vaccinated and boosted or have had an original infection is difficult to tweeze apart at this point. But I'm sure there are going to be endless number of papers written on the subject for the next 30 years.
The U.S. to answer?
Yes, Paul.
Are they going to be able to get this cryogenic type of deal where it's supposed to be very cold? In other words, go to your doctor's office now. You know, I get a flu shot in the doctor's office. Are they going to get it to a point where you could do that, or is everybody still going to be marching off to CVS?
I think it's going to be readily available in the doctor's office. And, yeah, there is a concern that as the weather turns cold, a lot of these viruses tend to be more infectious. Also, there's more inside interaction than outside interaction. So there's a whole bunch of things going on. And also, apparently, because of social distancing, last few years of influenza have kind of dipped down. So a lot of people who don't get vaccinated anyway are a little bit less immune to influenza. So the powers that be are concerning themselves that there might be a pickup on influenza this winter, as well as RSV, which is a childhood virus that gives cold-like symptoms. Any other questions or comments on this particular subject? Okay, well, this leads me to my last and final of the night, micro puzzler. So hopefully there'll be some discussion after this that kind of fills the space. If you wanted to find a location on the surface of this Earth that is the farthest away from the center of the Earth, where do you think you should be standing on?
What way do I?
Yes, Ann.
I would guess a mountain at the equator.
You are quite right. The problem is none of us probably know too many names of mountains on the equator.
Kilimanjaro?
No, I don't think that's on the equator.
I didn't think so, but it's close.
Is the Guatemala volcano at the equator?
No, where's the phone on?
About K2.
That's the Himalayas. Too far north.
About Mount Kenyatta.
I'm not sure how that is close to the equator. I guess I should study my geography more.
I know Quito, Ecuador is literally smack dab on the equator, but I'm not aware of any mountains there.
Are you familiar with Mount Chimborazo?
No.
Well, it's located in Ecuador.
So it's near Quito. It's the nearest mountain to Quito, then.
Yeah, yeah. It's very close to the equator. That's what gives it its distance from the center. Everest, as we all kind of hopefully know, is the tallest mountain from you know, just the ground level and going up the mountain. But you have to factor in the wonderful nature of our Earth is not a perfect sphere. It is a oblate sphere. So it's fat in the middle, skinny elsewhere. So it's that bulge from centrifugal force and such that gives it the extra distance. So the answer at the next cocktail party that you want to take this one out is Mount Chimborazo peak. Is the farthest distance away from the center of the Earth.
Did you say Chimborazo like the sausage?
It's called Chimborazo.
Okay, so it's like the sausage with a few extra lettuce on it.
Yep, that's the size of it.
Roy, if I'm not busting up anything, I thought about something that was going on when I signed a little while with WV280.
Sure, please, feel free. This was my last puzzler for the night. I think I threw out four of them. Three or four.
There was talk about chirp rate, C-H-I-R-P, with spread spectrum. No. With spread spectrum, it is a chip rate, C-H-I-P, like a potato chip, which is the way you do the spread spectrum. You add a finer resolution, like a 1 will become like, you know, a series of 1s and zeros. But there is a chirp rate, a pulse compression radar, actually does something like a chirpy CW signal that is a frequency shift. Like, you know, a chirpy signal, a Morse dial will have a chirp sound because the frequency shifts with the oscillator changes on the load when you see the transmitter. But they do that intentionally with a pulse compression radar. Let me drop it. And the reflected echo, there's a special filter that has different delays for different frequencies, and it all comes together and gives you a nice narrow pulse.
Oh, that's interesting to know. I mean, I think there's probably a lot of interesting information to be dug up on the subject of radars, radar technology. It was kind of the big secret at the beginning of World War II, and it made a massive impact, and the technology continues and is made more and more sophisticated over the many, many years. And I think, generally speaking, the average person, unfortunately, kind of knows quite about it.
Well, if you ever want me to educate you, I've dabbled in that stuff a lot. But the reason why you want to do that is a way of increasing the effective power of a radar as well as improving the resolution. Because to build a radar with that high a peak power, you probably have arcing over in the waveguide or whatever, or punch through on the coax for a UHF radar. Whereas this keeps the power level down to a sane level, but gives you the effective radiated power and range resolution that would otherwise be unattainable.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I mean, I've kind of used radar sparingly as a metaphor, analogy of quantum mechanics, Heisenberg uncertainty principle. The uncertainty principle is you cannot measure simultaneously momentum and position of objects. And I told this one to Dick, and I think he enjoyed it, that in some ways radar has the same duality. You can optimize a radar detection for location and velocity separately. You can't optimize them for both at the same time. So it was the closest I could come up with an analogy to the uncertainty principle.
I'm not sure I quite see that. But listen, I am home. Give me a little while and I'll be back on WV2EAB Mobile Quick.
Okay, very good, Ed. We'll wait for you. Once again, I'm AC2GS. My name is Roy. And this continues to be the Limar Technical Net. And we're here every Sunday morning, evening at 8 p.m. I fell into my 10 meter net. Anyone has any comments? Any topics for discussion or question? Hit that push to talk button. Say your piece.
You, FTP?
Yes, Chris.
Good evening, guys. Good evening, Roy. I got a question on DMR. I know very little about it. I got a DMR radio. In fact, I'm talking about it now, a little handheld. Somebody, I got it because I'm trying to listen to a DMR system up in Vermont that switched over to DMR. And somebody recently told me they think they're a trunk DMR, and I didn't know there was such a thing. Do you know anything about that? Is there trunk DMR systems?
I certainly hope not. This is the first time I heard it. You know, I mean, hopefully everyone knows what a trunk system is. We had a discussion about that a few months ago. That basically there's a channel that directs people to free channels, and without that capability, you don't know where you're supposed to be going. As far as I'm aware, DMR is not a trunk system. I mean, they might be working on something. I hope they don't, because I don't see the particular benefit when it comes to amateur radio-related DMR. We could go into the discussion of what DMR is. I've done it before, but I can do it again.
Well, actually, you could maybe you could touch on the basics. So it's not a ham radio DMR that I'm going to be listening to. It is commercial. It's just steam out. It's not a big deal. And somebody told me they're pretty sure it's a trunk DMR system that they switched to. Really surprising. It's a steam out, and they're very unsophisticated, of course. And they're coming from a simple analog repeater that's not much that I listened to for years and they've used for years. But yeah, if you want to educate me on DMR, as of right now, the only thing I know is it sounds horrible and it's a digital mode. Nice. KQSC, please.
KC2GS. My guess, again, just a guess, is that really what they mean is a digital trunking system as opposed to DMR. DMR is a brand name from Motorola, and there's Hyteria is a company that handles it in Europe. It is one of the three major amateur radio operators' voice digital mode technologies, the other being D-Star and Fusion. So it comes from Motorola. It was designed completely not to have anything to do with amateur radio. It is not amateur radio friendly. It is very business unfriendly in general. Motorola radios require you buying a license to operate their software, which could cost thousands of dollars, and they use a whole bunch of metaphors that are opaque to many amateur radio operators, to the point where code plugs are often shared at the beginning and only optimized, modified, changed. Very few people just sit down and write a code plug from zero. It entails concepts of time slots, color codes, and zones, which most hams don't know what that means unless you've done DMR before at a job. So the concept basically is to turn analog audio into digital signals. The problem is that the bandwidth would have to be humongous. So once you reduce it to a digital stream, you now have to figure out some way of compressing it in the same way that MP3s are radically, lossily compressed. For that, you use something called an AMBI chip. They were the first to peddle this technology, and I think they're still the only people to peddle this technology. They get a piece of the action for all three amateur radio digital modes, Fusion, AMBI, Star included. It converts the digital stream to a compressed digital stream, then depending upon which digital technology, uses slightly different phase shift keying to enable digital transmission. You can either send it off to a repeater. The repeater can either operate locally. Usually they have two time slots because the DMR technology uses time domain splitting. So you can have two completely separate repeaters operating on the same frequency at two different time slots that alternate. So one time slot usually is meant for local communications. The other one is meant for more global communications through the Internet. There's a voice over Internet protocol that spits out your audio stream to a server. Brandmeister is a very famous one, but there are other servers that do the same thing. and that connects disparate repeaters and people with hotspots. Hotspots have become very popular. You plug a little hotspot for $100, $150, and you could operate it through your handy talkie and talk on a lot of the servers that are cross-connected to repeaters all over the country.
Boy, I assume really just names for tones and different encoding formats, is that correct?
Well, it's a little bit more esoteric because at this point you're not dealing with analog signals, you're dealing with digital streams. So what happens is every audio stream that you send to a repeater or a hotspot has a packet header in the same way that IP packets have a header. And the header information is coding for time slots and for color codes and things like that. So it's no longer in the analog world where you'd have some kind of a tone to discern the differences between things.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, I knew there was going to be a learning curve on this DMR, but I got to learn it quick. I'm an avid skier, and they did switch to that, and you listened to them for several important reasons, one being emergency purposes. Being by myself in a backwoods often, and in the event I'm lost or hurt or stuck in there, I'd like to get some help. But I do listen to the snowmakers and whatnot at night. I got to study up on it, watch some YouTube about it, try to figure this all out. And I did plan on writing my own code plug, which is really just a plug into a radio for the programming, as I understand, to help Sanctuary K2SDG.
You're welcome, Chris. And you come back and then tell us the information. As far as I'm aware, you know, things change when you don't watch them closely. There's Tier 1 and Tier 2 DMR. I don't think there's a version of DMR that's specifically designed for trunking technology. Because usually when people move from the old commercial digital things like DMR, they move up to a different type of digital trunking system that they don't use the term DMR. So it'll be interesting to know. The problem with code plugs when you get into DMR, for the most part, is the metaphors change. So everyone's kind of used to simple code plugs for things otherwise. But when you have to understand about how you access a station by defining a zone. So you first have to define a channel. Then you have to define a talking group that the channel connects to, because you could have multiple entries for the same repeater with the same frequency, but they have a different talk group on them. And that gets piled into a subcategory called the zone, so that when you turn your handy talkie in the right position, it gives you that particular zone list. Otherwise, you can't, even though you have the channel and the talk group defined, the only way to get to it is by putting it in the zone. So it gets a little confusing. A lot of people will tend to share their code plugs originally, and then as they get more confident about it, it morphs into something a little bit different.
Gotcha, understood. And I do have all that information, so there's some guys that were scanning the area to pick up their needs. They knew they were putting a new system, and they standard listened in and got all of the codes, everything you just mentioned, and documented it and posted it. And so I do have that. I just got to figure out how I get it in the radio in what format. And, you know, they have the frequencies, the zones, color codes, talk groups. They have everything. Interestingly, it all came out the day they installed it. So I have a funny feeling it's people that work for the company installing it. But it's not real private information. Like I said, it's ours. So it's a ski resort, and it's all public info anyway, but appreciate it. K2SDG.
You're welcome, Chris, and please come back and tell us what you've learned, because I'd be interested to know if DMR has gone trunking. It's, you know, it's not the bane of my existence, because I don't hang out listening to this four box of Burger King, but it has made shortwave listeners really annoyed that their scanners kind of are more limited today than they once were.
And I have scanners, several of them that pick up DMR and have picked them up, but that's stuff you download and install. You don't have to necessarily program it yourself. But it's one stuff as a checkbox with a scan the DMR. But yeah, I'm really interested to find out if it's trunking, because I would have guessed that the, I mean, I have an Anisose, B78 Pro 2 Plus, and I doubt it. I mean, I didn't see anything mentioning on any kind of trunking on it. So I think somebody may have misspoke. The only thing that scares me is the guy that misspoke does know a lot of what he's doing. So it surprised me, and I did not think there was trunking in the CMR. I know that much. Mentioned that it was surprising. So I'll definitely report back what I find out. Thanks. Thank you, STP.
Okay. Once again, I'm curious. Perhaps he misspoke, maybe. Sometimes people insert the wrong words in places.
Could be, but it wasn't a document. That's the part that that bothers me. But I understand what you're saying. All right, thank you.
Okay, no, very good. Well, once again, I'm AT2GS. This is the Limark Dexcomet. So in 15 minutes before SpaceNet reports, if you're so inclined, so is anyone out there has any questions or comments or topics for discussion, feel free.
I'm available to follow up on any questions and anything I threw out earlier.
Scott?
Do you have a question?
I think, Paul, you doubled with Paul. Paul, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I was going to ask a good question. I mean, about a nuclear power plant that's going to be built in Poland. I'm not sure if he's still around. Anyway, Westinghouse, of course, an American company, is going to build three reactors somewhere in Poland. They said the northern part of Poland. But, you know, they're trying to get away from coal. And they looked at the different countries that could do this. And chose us. So I thought that was pretty good. I was just wondering what Wesley thought about that, because I know he's familiar with Europe.
Okay, Paul, I'll just do a shout-out. Perhaps Wesley had to walk away. Sometimes the cat keeps him busy. So, Wesley, if you're out there, Paul would like to know if you know anything about plans for three new nuclear power generators in Poland.
Okay, well, I'll ask during a week or something.
Okay. I mean, American companies have a lot of expertise. Unfortunately, the population is a little dicey when it comes to nuclear power. And so it's very difficult to get approvals, in other places that really desperately need the power. And, Poland is basically coal. Then you got to clean coal up. God forbid you have to buy something from the Russians these days. That's not a good option as well. There's a whole bunch of energy problems in Europe. Everyone's racing around to build liquid natural gas storage facilities so that it can be shipped in from other countries other than the pipeline that people keep blowing up that's connected to Russia and such. So, the rest of the world will suffer with nuclear energy and this risk. I don't perceive the United States moving on this at all. We're way too scared of what might happen, even though the worst thing that happened here wasn't that bad. What happened in Russia was bad, or rather in Ukraine was bad.
Okay. Yeah, well, in this country we have like 109 active nukes. And I think there was only one approved in the last 30 years, you know, for a new one. Anyway, of course, I'm a very pro-nuke. I came from an industry that, you know, that was very important. But I'd like to see, you know, it built there and some of the other NATO countries. It would be very well protected if it was a NATO country, unlike the Ukraine, where it's not protected. You know, they see the problems that they have with the nukes that's going on there. And, you know, if these countries start developing more and more of it, you know, maybe it would soften the attitude that they have here in the States. I'd like to see more of them built. Anyway, back to you, Ray.
Yes, Ed.
Yeah, I know a fair amount on that subject, but unfortunately nothing about what's going on with Poland. But if anybody has any questions, well, I have a question about Indian Point that's baffled me for a couple of years now. When Andrew Cuomo made the decision to shut down Indian Point rather than recertify it, I never understood why. I felt he never gave a good reason to justify in this day and age going from nuclear to fossil fuel energy for downstate New York. By any chance, Paul, do you either A, agree with me, or B, you have the answer I was looking for in the now?
Yeah, I was kind of surprised they did that. It's basically too close, in their opinion, to populated areas. They just don't want it there anymore. Well, I remember as a kid, I mean, I was very young. I went with my father to Indian Point, and they had a tour, you know, a special tour, you know, to see how everything was going to be done. So I'm going back, oh, that's probably 50 years ago. And I thought this was going to be the, you know, all throughout the country, you know, this was going to be the savior of energy, you know, until we developed fuel reactors. But of course, you know, it only went so far, and we had problems with Three Mile Island, and you know, well, you know the story. They should have never, in my opinion, shut that down. You just maintain it. That's it. You know, those concrete walls are not going to go anywhere. I guess back to you, Ed.
I had a tour at Indian Point, perhaps a tad more recently. Actually, I had a tour in 2012, and I think it was 2018. And it was through my college engineering alumni association, so the level of discussion was at a more detailed level, and I'm sure the time you went as a kid. But it was quite interesting. It was absolutely fascinating. I actually developed a professional presentation. You know, Roy is aware of, I gave a presentation at Emory University, and last spring I gave it to Parks at Lyme Martinez, which was based on a professional presentation done for the same group. Well, I did one on Indian Point and nuclear power for that same group. But saying that, the bottom line is, I understand they were concerned that there was some, there's always been the big bugaboo. But the bugaboo seems to be kind of, you know, overdrawn. Do you have any idea how many people have been killed by fossil fuel plant accidents and related stuff? And that they just gloss over completely. So there is no easy answer. But at this time, when everybody is heaven and earth go from fossil fuels to renewables, or at least non-carbon producing, to take 2.1 gigawatts and go from nuclear to totally fossil fuel, frack gas from Pennsylvania, not even from New York, just always amazed me in a negative way. Thanks, Roy.
Okay, this is AC2GS. You know, I mean, if there's one thing Andrew Cuomo can do is read politics, and this is a perfect example of not in my backyard. You know, there's a lot of people just anti-nukes no matter what. Anything that says radiation frightens them and worries them, and so be it. But especially in your backyard, you don't want it. So I think it was just a political move on Andrew's part. He's given to that. So I think that's enough justification for his opinion and his actions. That's all that he needs.
Yeah, one other thing. You know, everybody worries about the safety, and there might be some movement in the ground and it might cause a problem. But, you know, you have ships at sea who have aircraft carriers, you know, that are run on nukes. You have submarines, you know, floating around the high seas. And, you know, they pull into ports and they think nothing of it. And you don't see any protesters down there when a nuclear sub pulls in. Anyway, back to you, Roy.
Ed, you want to say something? I just want to mention that human beings have terrible risk assessment, generally speaking. Most human beings are not able to correctly assess any risk. You take it back to the old days. Florsheim shoe stores had fluoroscopes where you could x-ray your feet through your shoes. So lots of nice x-ray radiation. But on the flip side, when they electrified warehouses and manufacturing buildings, the workers demanded a hazard pay because the fact that there were utility electricity in the building put their lives at risk. So we're terrible at risk assessment. But Ed, you want to say something?
Well, one reason why there's no human flight, the Navy, U.S. Navy, regularly monitors harbors where all submarines go for radiation. I know that for a fact.
Yeah, but do you think the average guy who's just kind of anti-radiation in general is aware of any of this? I think it's simply that you can't point to a nuclear reactor because it's moving, and most people don't live very near ports where the nuclear submarines land and are identified as such. So if they're out of your eyesight, they don't exist. It works fine for two-year-olds.
That was intended as a very specific answer to Paul's specific comment. And I will tell you, I don't know where it is, but there is on the internet, every year, the U.S. Navy publicly publishes a book with the latest studies on that, so there's nothing classified about it.
Okay, that's a good thing. I don't think I ever heard about it before. I'd be curious what percentage of the population have pulled down those records. I would strongly sense it was significantly less than 1%, but I think transparency is, generally speaking, a very good thing.
I also know for a fact, most members of Congress and the Vice President get a copy every year. If any member of their staff even opens it, I'd be surprised, but they do receive it.
Well, I don't want to disparage Congress. I think their interns and such do most of the reading for them, unfortunately.
Now, it's Paul Guys, so I asked a question.
You're about 50% noise. I couldn't make out the question. It sounded like you have a question for Paul.
Yes, this should be better. It's Paul Solaris, I assume
so. Still here, and yeah, you sound good.
Yeah, I'm using an HG in my bedroom with a half-wave telescoping antenna on it. It's very location-dependent. That one in Poland, I doubt you know the answer, but would you know if it's a uranium-based reactor with you know, high pressure water cooling as opposed to, you know, some exotic thing like thorium or with liquid sodium for heat transfer.
No, I haven't seen any designs on it yet. Apparently they